Well, first of all, many thanks to Peter Rose for inviting me to be the guest lecturer this year. I was very touched. And to Nick Jose for inviting me to join the creative writing program for a couple of weeks here at Adelaide University. And to all of you, many of whom I know, if you continue to do that, sir, we will have you out. And for many of you who I know for coming here tonight at dinner time, which I think is personally heroic. I think also it was quite daring of Peter to ask me to. I am known for some controversial statements that I have made in the past, and I haven't necessarily reformed, so you may even hear some tonight. Last year in this ABR lecture series, Ian Donaldson gave a sparkling talk on biography. He told us that it has emerged as something of a cultural phenomenon in recent years, with a biography section at the front of many bookstores, and it's generally accepted that the genre has endless possibilities. Biographers have now written about London, Paris, the pineapple and the potato, and that despite its dissenters, biography has even become acceptable within the academy. My brother, who's a pediatrician who works in intensive care, has been known to end phone conversations by saying, "Gotta go, got lives to save." Ever since Ian Donaldson's talk with its wonderful title last year, Matters of Life and Death, The Return of Biography, I feel able to say, "Gotta go, got lives to write." This year you will again be hearing about biography, but this time, as my title suggests, the ups, the downs, my life as a biographer, you're going to get the inside story. This is what I propose to you. I take a strange delight in that expression. I think it comes from French blackboards outside cafes where they put "on vous propose" and then comes the menu. For starters, I will talk about the skills a biographer has to develop and why biographies really are a matter of life and death. We will then pick up our steak knives, and I will discuss my own trajectory as a biographer, taking full advantage of my position at the podium to throw in some personal reflections about existentialism, universities, and public intellectuals. By this time, it will be the moment to sink our spoons into something soft and sweet, and I will come out with a confession. Since I have chosen biographical subjects that have been risky, and I am not someone who deludes herself about the difficulties ahead, I have often been cruelly susceptible to what Christina Stead used to call the 3 AMs. Before we go our separate ways, I will let you know whether I feel the anguish has been worth it. I began my first biography on Christina Stead in 1985 when I was a tutor in literary studies at Deakin University. And so, as I stand here today, I'm looking back at more than 20 years of writing biography and biographical essays. From this vantage point, what do I think are the skills that a biographer has to develop? It seems to me that you need to be curious about the world, to like people and be interested in their lives, and enjoy drawing out their stories. You need to be doggedly determined and tenacious. Your research has to be scrupulously correct, or the scholars will wring your neck. You can't invent facts. You can't build up atmosphere by saying it was snowing in New York that day if it wasn't. Once you've lost your credibility, you're a dead duck. To write serious biography, it seems to me that you need a strong interest in history, politics, and psychology, but this knowledge is simply part of your palette. It has to be very delicately woven into the narrative. I don't think you'd get very far if you didn't have an adventurous spirit and were not prepared to take risks. And like all writers, you have to be prepared to invest your time and energy in a very uncertain future. But ultimately, the most important thing is your storytelling ability. A good biography has to be every bit as absorbing as a good novel or a good film, even if it is about a potato. So you see that biographies do carry a big responsibility. It's not just my brother who... They have someone's life in their hands. What's unjust is that if you read a dull biography, you come away thinking that person's life was dull, whereas in fact that person's life was almost never dull. It's the narrative that's dull. No wonder people are wary of biographers. It's bad enough to die. We don't want some dullard turning our lives into insipid gruel. It's interesting for me to reflect on the path that led me to biography. And though this exercise performed in public seems to me disconcertingly self-indulgent, I blame Peter Rose and Nick Jose, who encouraged me to give this autobiographical talk. But I hope you will also see it as the biographer's mind at work, because these are the kinds of speculations, mostly about other people, that fill my days. Looking back, I'm struck by how fortunate I've been, both in terms of historical timing and my personal circumstances. I've also made some quite dramatic choices. They're complex things, choices, and the existentialists would say that they come from deep within us, reflecting some sort of original choice we made in our childhood. Certain moments stand out when people said something to me that caused a click in my mind. But why these moments and not others? You have to want to hear these words. They have to strike a chord in you. So ultimately, other people influence you only in ways you choose to be influenced. Since my early 20s, I've been deeply influenced by existentialism, a philosophy which fundamentally is all about a reflection on the extent to which people are free or not free. The question that most interested the existentialists was, in what ways do we make ourselves out of what we have been made? In her memoirs, Simone de Beauvoir muses, how is a life formed? How much of it is made up by circumstances? How much by chance? And how much by the subject's own options and his personal initiatives? In their own biographical and autobiographical writings, Sartre and Beauvoir examined their subjects' situation, as they called it, meaning the historical period, social class, family dynamics, the person's physical constitution, their appearance, and so on, while scrutinizing as if under a microscope any actions that were signs of rebellion or compliance. Because these are the moments they saw as defining moments, which reflected a deep-seated choice of being. In other words, these were the moments of existential choice. Do you agree with what somebody's making you? Do you rebel against what that person's trying to make you into? And so on. I had no say in this whatsoever, but I often think how lucky I was to have been born in the early 1950s. I'm grateful to have been brought up before the internet, mobile phones, Blackberries and iPods made kids into jittery, easily bored, semi-autistic creatures who, by being so fanatically plugged into the virtual world, have no time left for the world of the imagination. When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, my family didn't have television as a matter of principle, though we usually rented a set during the summer holidays. I was an avid reader, and it seemed to me that there was nothing more noble and exciting than being a writer, having the power to transport people into another world. From the age of 9 or so, I wanted to be a writer. One summer in Adelaide, I wrote a novel with a girlfriend. We sat at a folding table beside her family's swimming pool. One wrote while the other read or swam. Then the roles were reversed, and the other one took up the story. Her father handed the manuscript to Nancy Cato, the South Australian writer, who was encouraging and told us to persevere. Every summer during high school, I wrote short stories in notebooks, then typed them up on my Remington manual and sent them off to magazines. They were all rejected, but even the rejection slips made me feel proud. Real writers get rejection slips. During my student years, I wrote less for the sheer pleasure of writing. I had less time and more distractions, such as falling in love. This was the late 60s and 70s, when societies all over the Western world were undergoing fundamental changes. I had been politically active from the moment I started university, the anti-apartheid campaign, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, women's liberation, and we students were convinced we were going to change the world forever. It was a heady period in which to come of age, especially for women. I remember feeling sorry for Simone de Beauvoir, who had done so much to inspire the women's movement and wouldn't be alive to see what I took for granted my generation would see, a complete transformation of society, with all of us working half-time due to technological advances, and true equality between the sexes. I took a combined honours degree in French and German. I loved languages and the worlds they opened up. A German fellowship allowed me to spend 2 years at the University of Freiburg attending lectures and making a start on my PhD. Then I went just across the border to Strasbourg, supported by an Australian Commonwealth scholarship. In both Germany and France, I was active in the women's movement. In Paris, I got to interview the woman who by this time exerted more influence on my life than anyone else, Simone de Beauvoir. Altogether, I spent 3 years away from Australia, and this was before email, before long-distance phone calls were cheap. There was no hand-holding from home. I was completely immersed in two very different cultures. It was a marvelous experience for a future writer. I wrote my PhD dissertation on Simone de Beauvoir, an existentialist biography. One of the many things I liked about Sartre and Beauvoir were their lifelong interest in biography. Another was their commitment to being public intellectuals, who considered it their responsibility to speak out about oppression, injustice, and the forces that militated against individual freedom. They were also interested in our own complicity in our non-freedom, a state of mind they called bad faith, mauvaise foi. In The Second Sex, Simone de Beauvoir shows how tempting it is for women to slip into certain roles rather than taking the harder road, which is to assume the burden of their freedom. After World War II and the deaths of close friends at the front, in the Holocaust, and the resistance, Sartre and Beauvoir were highly conscious of the limitations of individual freedom. Nevertheless, they argued that individuals have a degree of choice, whatever our circumstances. This, to me, is the burning question at the core of biography. What makes it possible for a handsome, athletic man who is struck by polio at the age of 39 and never again able to take a single step on his own, and this at a time when the words infantile paralysis and cripple carried a severe social stigma, what made it possible for him to become president of the United States? How does a shy, awkward woman with buck teeth and a wavering falsetto voice become one of the most effective speakers of her time and the most outspoken, independent, courageous, admired, controversial, and savagely mocked first lady the US has ever known? As you may have guessed, I'm currently writing a book about the Roosevelt marriage. A humanities PhD is, of course, terrific training and research and building up a sustained argument. Whereas in the US, a humanities PhD involves 3 years of coursework followed by a dissertation supervised by a committee of three, a humanities PhD in the British Australian system generally involves no coursework whatsoever. At least in my time, you would sit at home or in the library or postgraduate room for 4 or 5 years, incubating a thick dissertation with occasional meetings with your supervisor. It tested your powers to withstand isolation. I suppose that is quite useful for a future writer. You came out of the experience as chastened as a monk, quivering with self-doubt. I suppose that too is useful for a future writer. But one thing was not at all useful for a future writer, and it still isn't, and that is the language of the academy. English departments should be imparting the pleasure and power of playing one of the world's richest languages like a musical instrument. And sadly enough, they are among the worst strongholds of academic jargon. By the early 80s, when I was finishing my PhD, postmodernism was in vogue, and postgraduate theses clanked with words like discourse, marginality, signifier, masculinist, and to problematize. For the last 30 years, the reigning ethos in humanities has been that in order to appear intelligent, your sentences have to appear unintelligible. Fortunately for me, I was extremely resistant to this pressure, I regarded it as a nasty virus. My PhD was in French studies, but I wrote it in English, and it was about history and philosophy as much as about literature. I didn't want to teach in a French department. I wasn't qualified to teach in an English department. I was 31, and it wasn't at all clear what I was going to do with my life. I did various part-time jobs, some writing, and quite a bit of worrying. And then a piece of extraordinary luck came my way. Despite the fact that we had for years been talking about interdisciplinarity, universities were still rigidly divided into departments. The very word, when you think about it, sounds like something out of Kafka. What good fortune I had in 1984 to crack a job in literary studies at Deakin University, at the time probably the most interdisciplinary university in the country. The literary studies area was keen to employ somebody who didn't have a standard English department degree, and I was thrilled to have the freedom to range across disciplines pretty much as I liked. I could teach French, English, German, in translation, Russian if I wanted. Deakin was regarded as the equivalent of Britain's Open University, a progressive sort of place which offered education to working people who wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity to study. In order to write course material for our long-distance students, we formed teams and planned the course content together. These meetings sometimes involved hefty arguments, but this was part of the stimulation. Even with our on-campus teaching, we team-taught, and I personally learned a great deal from my colleagues. It was challenging to have the two sets of students, the younger on-campus students, who mostly came from the Geelong area, and the highly motivated mature-age students who came from all over Victoria and sometimes from interstate, whom we met at occasional weekend schools. Deakin academics were not segregated into departments. The literary studies area was part of the School of Humanities, and our offices were scattered throughout the building. I shared my corridor with philosophers, sociologists, and political scientists. And the humanities staff were expected to attend each other's seminars. For me, this setup could not have been more ideal. And dare I remind you, we had 6 months study leave every 3 years on full pay, and provided we were presenting a paper, the university funded an international conference every year. Luckily, I was aware at the time how good these conditions were. It would have been sad to realize it only afterwards. Because we were going to look back on this as the tail end of a golden period in the academy. Academics are expected to write books, and there was nothing I wanted to do more. I had no trouble deciding to write a biography. That had been the thrust of my PhD thesis, and biography was interdisciplinary, and I would be writing for the general reader rather than for the academy. But deciding on the subject proved a torturous process. I wanted to write about a woman writer, and no doubt I was looking for some sort of a model. Since coming to Deakin, I'd been reading my way through Australian literature. For the first time in my life, I might add, since my generation at high school hardly touched Australian literature. And I wanted an excuse to dive in deeper. I was fascinated by Henry Handel Richardson, Catherine Susanna Pritchard, Dimphna Kuzak, and Christina Stead. For various reasons, I whittled the choice down to Kuzak and Stead, and was favoring Kuzak because she was a more minor writer, and it struck me that's how I should start. I completely lacked confidence, and it seemed far too daunting to take on Stead, a towering international figure. "She's too big," I told my boyfriend. "Why start small?" he said. I have found in life that the anticipation is nearly always worse than the challenge itself. Once I got started, I was in my element. I made an appointment with Brenda Nile, a biographer I knew and admired, and she gave me some excellent tips. She showed me how she organized her files, one manila folder for every year of her subject's life, and how she cross-referenced details on index cards. "When you interview people," she told me, "don't just ask them about Christina Stead, ask them about themselves. After all, they're characters in your book." We discussed taping versus note-taking, and agreed that it depended on the situation, but it was always a good idea to take notes. And the most important thing was to sit down somewhere straight after the interview when it was fresh in your mind and go through your notes and add a few more. I set up a reading group in Australian literature. The funny thing is that people realize that I didn't know a great deal about being a black man in America, But they imagine I knew a lot about Australian literature just because I happened to be Australian. I knew nothing. I set up a reading group in Australian literature, and four of us met each month for several years, a precious memory for all of us. I gave my chapters to a friend who saw it as her mission to make me throw away what she called my academic boots, and who would write "boring" and "cut" in the margin whenever she felt the narrative pace was lagging. My working conditions were perfect, a six-month study leave spent in London and New York, where I conducted dozens of interviews, and long summer breaks with no teaching. In the final year of writing, I took unpaid leave. The book came out in 1993, published by Heinemann, and you can imagine my elation when, along with Dorothy Hewitt for poetry and Elizabeth Jolly for fiction, I won the Banjo Prize for nonfiction. After the Stead book came out in 1994, I had another six-month study leave. And of all places to go to, I freely went, of my own volition, to Austin, Texas. I owe this experience to my friend Frank Campbell. We were sitting in the Deakin Staff Club, and I told him that much as I liked both places, I was tired of feeling lonely in New York and London. "Go to Austin," he said. "Why on earth would I go there?" I said. "The university has a fantastic library," he said. "Oil money. I have friends there, an interracial couple who have a kind of open house on Sunday afternoons. Through them, you'll meet everyone interesting in town." Until I went to Texas, I had to some extent swallowed the myth that America is a gigantic melting pot. It looks that way on the surface, particularly in the subways and on the streets of New York City. In Texas, I discovered American apartheid. I saw that poverty and police abuse had a great deal to do with skin color. I saw that even in educated circles, perhaps especially in educated circles, black people and white people rarely had dinner at each other's houses. A notable exception was the veranda of the sprawling Southern Gothic house where I spent my Sunday afternoons, and where a handsome young African-American told me that Richard Wright had changed his life. Little did I realize that steamy October afternoon that he would change mine too. While I was in Texas, my Christina Stead book was published in the US by Henry Holt and received glowing reviews. Over lunch in New York on my way back to Australia, my publisher asked me what I wanted to write next. I said I'd like to write about Richard Wright. She put her head in her hands and looked at me through her fingers. She asked me why, and I told her that I thought race the most fraught and complex subject in America, and I wanted to try to understand it from the inside outside, and Richard Wright was such a powerfully visceral writer that he made me feel what it was like to be a black boy growing up in segregated Mississippi in the 1910s and 20s with grandparents who had all been slaves, and an uncle who was lynched for running a business that was too successful. Wright had felt in exile in his own country, first in the Deep South and then in the North. In 1946, he and his wife left the US in disgust. And whereas most immigrants to New York write idyllically about how glorious it is when the sun shines on the Statue of Liberty and they enter the land of freedom at last, Wright wrote in his journal as he stood on the ship, "I felt relieved when my ship sailed past the Statue of Liberty, but he was on the way out." They moved to Paris, and at first Wright could scarcely believe his new freedom. But it was the beginning of the Cold War, and as a black American writer who spoke out about American race relations, Wright could not escape the tentacles of the U.S. State Department. Paris was bristling with spies and informers, and Wright knew he was being closely watched. We will probably never know for certain whether his premature death in 1960 at the age of 52 was natural or helped along by the CIA. By this time, my publisher had taken her head out of her hands. "I like your outsider perspective," she said. "It's fresh, and I like your passion. If you write a good proposal, we'll publish you." That, I think, is the best of America. They are very open. I don't know that in England or Australia that they would have said that to me. They would have said, "What are your qualifications?" But back in Melbourne, I was intensely aware of my hubris. would I ever be able to understand, let alone convey, the experience of a black man in America? I was not American, I wasn't black, I wasn't a man. I struggled with the question of legitimacy, the feeling that I didn't belong at the other side of that high invisible fence that separates black and white America. Henry Holt was courageous enough to offer me a substantial advance, but before I had signed anything, I backed out, scared. One day, the phone rang. It was Jock McCulloch, a friend of mine, then a colleague at Deakin, who had written a great deal about race. He said, "I'm going to say something and then hang up. Listen, Hazel, a publisher has offered you a good advance. You want to be a writer. You want to broaden your horizons. You want to know more about race. You've got a fascinating subject. Do you want to spend the rest of your days knowing you didn't have the courage? That's all I want to say. Think about it." A click, and the line went quiet. In the next few weeks, the figure of Richard Wright loomed before me. His whole life had been about courage, determination, and daring. He had always grappled with the sense that he was an interloper in territory meant only for whites. He hadn't given in, had he? Needless to say, the people at Henry Holt were not impressed by my vacillations, and I had to write a very convincing proposal to persuade them to take me back on board. At first, I thought I would take unpaid leave to research the book in the US, but by now it was the mid-90s, and the Australian academic world had changed. Almost overnight, universities became businesses. We were seeing the rise of the bureaucrat and the demise of the intellectual. The government decreed that universities had to prove their worth in order to gain funding, but the criteria for measuring intellectual endeavour were so ludicrous that I came to the conclusion I couldn't be the kind of writer I wanted to be under these conditions. At the age of 45, I took a package, as it was called. Tied in with this decision was another, to leave Australia. I was 8 when my family came to Adelaide from England. I had studied French and German. My soul has always belonged to Europe. North America was a new episode, and I would see whether I wanted to stay there or not, but at least it was closer to Europe. I sold my St Kilda apartment. I sold my car. I had written an article for The Australian explaining why I felt obliged to leave the university system. And it came out on the very day I was leaving my apartment to spend Christmas with my family before departing for the US. That morning, before my phone was cut off at midday, there I was taping boxes, I received 58 phone calls from academics around the country thanking me for saying what I'd said. So if the phone hadn't been cut off. I was stepping into the unknown and taking a huge risk, financial, professional, and personal. And nor was I 20 anymore. But sometimes in life, you know what you don't want more clearly than what you want. It's funny, too, how your head rattles with clichés when you make an existential choice. Life is short, I told myself. It's now or never. Take the plunge. I even remembered something a Marxist boyfriend used to say 20 years earlier in Germany. Wer, wenn nicht wir? Wann, wenn nicht jetzt? Who, if not us? When, if not now? I went to the US on a 3-year visa and had no idea what I would do when that expired. To my astonishment, I obtained a green card with remarkable ease, in a category the name of which I relish, alien of exceptional ability. The Americans really do think these up, don't they? But meanwhile, I was an alien, and I had a book to write on the most fraught and emotional subject in America, race. It wasn't just that I knew next to nothing about the subject matter. I didn't know much about my readers either. The least of my problems was to change over to American spelling. I had to find out fast what American readers knew about their history, about race issues, and how they talked about it. I'm exceedingly grateful that the Du Bois Institute in African American Studies at Harvard made me a visiting fellow a privilege they extended year after year. I had full-fledged faculty rights to the faculty club, the gym, Harvard health insurance, and the library, which allowed you to borrow books for a year unless a book was recalled because someone else wanted it. So actually, I had 80 books from the library in my bookcase at home. Save me buying any. Professor Henry Louis Gates welcomed scholars from Africa, Europe, and elsewhere. He didn't want African-American studies to be a ghetto. We came together as a group every Wednesday for a two-hour lunchtime seminar. In that Harvard common room, among the Persian rugs, the deer antlers, and the portraits of white men, we heard speakers from all over the world and engaged in animated discussion about race issues. So I think I owe it to those seminars that I can pick up the tone and what people knew and what they didn't know, and therefore how to... I quickly learnt more about my readership. Richard Wright took me to the black ghettos of Mississippi, the south side of Chicago, to Harlem. There were days when the only white person I saw was myself in the mirror. As it turned out, it was a real advantage to be an outsider. My accent gave me license to ask questions I couldn't have asked if I'd been a white American. I don't mean naive questions. I don't think that would have impressed them. But I could sort of say to them, you know, I don't understand. Explain to me. You know, explain to me how that works. You know, give me the technicolor. And with my accent, you got away. I mean, I don't think a white American could have said, explain to me how it works. They'd say, you damn well should know. So at first, sometimes my black interviewees would look at me with bemusement, you know, arms crossed. But when they saw that I'd done my research thoroughly and was open-minded and not prejudiced, they talked to me more frankly than I had dared to hope for. When I finished the manuscript, I gave it to American friends to vet, black friends and white friends. Nevertheless, I was scared of the reviews. Would they call me a naive white woman from Australia? The publisher's blurb on the back of the book made me sound like an American. I also noticed that the publishers left off the author's photo. When I asked about it, they pretended it was a question of space. In fact, the marketing people, as you've guessed, didn't want to reveal my colour. The book came out in August 2001. And had cover reviews in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Chicago Tribune. I was very proud that the highest praise came from prominent black male intellectuals. The Washington Post reviewer, an African-American writer who lives in Paris, who I met a year later, told me afterwards that he could tell from certain sentences that I wasn't American, but he hadn't been able to work out throughout the book whether I was black or white, and it kind of obsessed him, it interested him. In the US, you see, the name Hazel is possibly more a black name than a white name, kind of old-fashioned black nanny. But 2 weeks after publication, a disaster occurred that took all discussion of books off the airwaves, devastated the New York theatre season, and made numerous businesses go bankrupt. September the 11th, 2001, reminded me what it meant that Christina Stead's The Man Who Loved Children came out in 1940. I have sometimes compared biography to writing biography to being in love. This sounds melodramatic, and nor is it quite accurate, since it's essential for a biographer to keep her lucidity and to remain in control of her subject matter, and that's not quite akin to my experience of being in love. But there are striking parallels. My books are voyages, risky voyages, involving a great deal of passion on my part. I choose subjects that will open up new worlds for me. It has always been a harrowing decision for me to commit myself to a subject. I know I'll be living with that person day and night for 2 to 4 years. A lot of energy and empathy goes into putting yourself in someone else's shoes. You inevitably become obsessed. And you have to follow that person wherever he or she takes you. I write about people I deeply admire, but they are always flawed, and you end up grappling with these flaws as if they were your partners. Rather than judging them, my energy goes into understanding them, which is something I'm prepared to do only with people I love. Finally, I finish the book. Do I feel relieved? No, it's the end of an affair. To write about Sartre and Beauvoir, I moved to Paris, rented a fifth-floor walk-up looking onto slate rooftops and terracotta chimney pots, filled it with my books, and went out to talk to those who remained from Beauvoir and Sartre's intimate circle. I found this a much easier book to write than the previous two. This time I was writing a book where I already knew quite a lot about the subject matter. And by now I was more confident as a storyteller. I had fun with tête-à-tête from beginning to end. Once again, it was an advantage to be an outsider. The Parisian intellectual world, I would discover, consists of cliques who in their loyalties and hatreds are not unlike the gangs in West Side Story. I came with credentials, which was important, but the French couldn't quite place me. As a foreigner, I felt less bound by what I could and couldn't say about this iconic French couple. It was just as well that I was a more experienced biographer, because this time I was negotiating a path between two camps, the Beauvoir camp and the Sartre camp, who on the whole detest each other. I had to be constantly aware of the viewpoint of the person I was talking to and judiciously sift everything he or she told me. And when I was younger, I would have been terribly intimidated by these French intellectuals. I had been duly warned that Claude Lanzmann, the filmmaker and Shoah, right, and former boyfriend of Simone de Beauvoir, would probably not consent to see me, and that if he did, he would be abominably rude. Well, he put me through every possible hoop before agreeing to, but he did see me several times. On the first occasion, he had me come to his vacation home on the west coast of France. He set up his tape recorder in case he needed to sue me, he said. We would talk for 2 hours at most, he said, and then we would go out in his boat, where he proceeded to flirt with me quite outrageously. 10 minutes in, I asked him something and he exploded. Mais c'est une question idiote! I said, maybe it is, but I'd like you to answer it anyway. He looked at me with fury. I gazed at the sky. 2 minutes passed. Finally, he spoke, and of course it was his most interesting reply because it was the question he was resisting. I don't think I could have done that when I was 20. These are the things that compensate for being in one's 50s. You can handle Claude Lanzmann. What were the main difficulties I had in writing tête-à-tête? Nearly all the books by Beauvoir and Sartre are fat doorstoppers. So are the biographies about them. I was determined to keep my story concise and rapid-moving. I wanted to write a medium-sized book that readers could hold comfortably in bed. But how to do that? I was dealing with not one central character, but two. And then there was what they called la petite famille, the friends and lovers. I was drowning in material. The answer, I realized, was selectivity. Sublime detail, but no superfluous detail. And I wanted the book, I told myself, to leave readers lusting for more. I mean, writers are seducers, really. That is what it's all about, writing. My other worry was more of a moral problem. I was writing a book about people I admired, and I was acutely conscious of the danger of trivializing them. I wanted to tell the truth about this relationship, and I didn't want to whitewash their behavior in any way. But the fact is, Sartre and Beauvoir's love life does not always show them in their best light. I took pains to sketch in the broader picture, their philosophy, their incredible capacity for hard work, their courage as public intellectuals. Both were, at times, the target of extraordinary hostility. Sartre and Beauvoir have always aroused passion, admiration, and hatred. And the reaction to my book shows that they still do. Some reviewers praised me for not being at all judgmental and then proceeded to dance a furious little jig themselves, denouncing Sartre and Beauvoir as monstrous, immoral, and sexually depraved. A reviewer in Le Monde surmised that we were once again experiencing American Puritanism. Rosemary Sorensen in this country wrote in the Brisbane Courier Mail, "I do wonder if some of the animosity is envy hiding behind prissy Puritanism." I agreed with her. For me, the surprise was when the book came out in the UK and a couple of reviewers in that country reacted like maddened 17th century Salem witch hunters, this time raging against me as well as Sartre and Beauvoir. In fact, the nastiest came from Peter Conrad, you know, who was brought up in Tasmania and now lives in London and seemed to have an absolute thing against Beauvoir and Sartre, but and me too. He said that I came from prissy Adelaide. I thought I'd get some sympathy from you about that. And that I was clearly starstruck by these awful Parisians with their loose morality. One of the problems with biography is that it attracts reviewers who already have strong views about your subject, and sometimes, as their pontifications make clear, they scarcely even read your book. This brings me to the question of judgment. In my last two books, Richard Wright and Tête-à-Tête, I have left all judgment out of the narrative. I've done this deliberately. I see it as my task to present the facts, to tell a good story, and to leave it up to readers to decide what they think. Of course, you could argue that my choice of what to put in and leave out is already a kind of judgment. I'm steering the reader's opinions. I would normally agree, but the fact is, my steering lands readers all over the landscape. Those who were already attracted to Sartre and Beauvoir tell me that they found my book deeply moving and they cried in several places. Those who already dislike them tell me that my book made them seem thoroughly dislikable. With Tête-à-Tête, I have finally learnt that my readers and I do not necessarily think the same way, and it's probably not a good idea to write a book that provides a kind of blank slate on which readers project their own emotions. For my Roosevelt book, I've decided to include more authorial comment, not judgment, but a little elbowing, as I did, in fact, in my Christina Stead book. One of the rewards of writing biography is that it gives you a perspective on our times. It gives you a long view of history. My three biographies have been about people born in the first decade of the 20th century, and I'm more and more struck by the parallels between that generation and my own. Stead was born in 1902, Sartre in 1905, Beauvoir and Wright in 1908. They came of age in the late 20s and 30s. When the left was strong, revolutionary Russia seemed to be a beacon of hope, and women enjoyed a new freedom. By the late 40s, everything had changed. World War II was followed by the Cold War, and the United States was in a position of global eminence. At home, Joe McCarthy and J. Edgar Hoover created an atmosphere of fear, conservatism, and guilt by association. The left was brutally suppressed. As writers, Richard Wright and Christina Stead more or less disappeared from view. Stead's work was too angry, too critical of society for the conservative 1950s. Richard Wright was writing nonfiction in the 50s in Paris. His book Black Power about the Gold Coast, soon to become Ghana, and Pagan Spain about Spain under Franco contain some of his best writing ever, in my opinion. But the Western world was deeply threatened by the independence of Ghana, and America had just signed an important economic and military treaty with Franco. Wright told a friend, "So far as Americans are concerned, I'm worse than a communist, for my work falls like a shadow across their policy in Asia and Africa. Truth-telling today," he said, "is both unpopular and suspect." As public intellectuals, Sartre and Beauvoir were famous in the 50s. They were not eclipsed like Richard Wright and Christina Stead, but they were widely hated, and Beauvoir writes that they felt in exile in their own country. France was fighting a vicious colonial war in Algeria, and the French press was in cahoots with the government. There was silence about the unbelievable torture methods the French army was using. The press didn't even call it the Algerian War. They called it the Algerian Question, or the Troubles in Algeria. Sartre and Beauvoir, in their journal, Les Temps Modernes, were one of the few intellectuals in France to talk about the torture that was being used and also to be in favor of Algerian independence. And in the early 60s, their lives were in such danger that they had to go into hiding. Sartre's apartment was twice torn apart by a dynamite bomb. If he had been at home, he probably would have been dead. So that's that generation where everything changed. I would say 46, 47, end of the Second World War, new conservatism. My generation came of age in the late 60s and 70s, a time of revolutionary change and hope. And then, it happened sometime in the 90s, everything changed. These days, I think that most of my friends in the Anglo-Saxon world, whether we live in Australia, the US, or the UK, would say that we feel in exile in our own country. With that mindless slogan, "War against terror," our governments have brought war and terror to Iraq and have taken our own countries into an endless war. While our leaders jabber on about freedom and democracy, we are seeing our freedoms brutally curtailed. Kurt Vonnegut, a writer who could not contain his disgust with the Bush government and never lost the courage to speak out, he died recently, wrote in his memoirs, "Our daily news sources, newspapers and TV are now so craven, so unvigilant on behalf of the American people, so uninformative, that only in books do we know what's really going, do we learn what's really going on. I am a man without a country, except for the librarians." I would say the same. I do not have a country. And in any event, I have always been wary of nationalism. I gain strength and nourishment from the people I write about, people who lived in difficult times and who never gave up the fight, the struggle, the hard work. And I'm tremendously inspired by public intellectuals who speak out, by independent, unembedded journalists, by publishers and newspaper editors, magazine editors, who publish books and articles that are important rather than safe or commercially viable, and by the owners of independent bookstores who are fighting a heroic and losing battle against the chain bookstores, which increasingly determine which books make it and which books don't. I promised to end this talk with a confession. I said I would tell you whether I think the anguish of being a biographer has been worth it. How shall I put it? Writing is harrowing. Out of a spider web, a vague notion in your head, you have to create a book. You write a proposal first, which may take you months, because if you want to get money out of a publisher, that proposal had better be good. My Roosevelt proposal has just taken me 6 months of research, and then you have to suggest that there might be interest in film and that there might be a reason for them to publish you. And all that period is very anguished. I mean, you're not getting any pay for writing a proposal. It can clunk. I have had a proposal about the blacklist. I was going to write a book about the 1950s blacklisted film directors who went to Mexico, London, and Paris. And that went in October 2001. And every publisher in New York turned it down. They didn't want to know about nice un-Americans. So this is, I mean, my anxiety levels have risen hugely. My sleep has decreased. The 3 a.m.s have got worse. You're expected to produce your book on time, and it had better be a page turner, or the publishers will want their advance back. For every photo in these books, for every significant quotation, I have had to get copyright permission. This can take months and has cost me, in each case, several thousand dollars. Publishers never pay for that. And then the book comes out, and we writers have all had this experience. It's hidden at the back of the bookstores. Borders classified tete-a-tete under philosophy and then under R for Rowley, which was kind of the bottom shelf. There are always at least a couple of killer reviews, and you're supposed to take them with a shrug. And if the book doesn't sell, somehow it's always your fault, you, the writer. You're the one to blame. And yet, there are ups and there are downs, but as I see it, being a writer is an enormous privilege. Your life and work blur into one. Whatever you do, you can tell yourself it's experience, and after all, that's what a writer most needs. While the world is full of people carrying out various forms of alienated labor, I look at my watch not because the days drag, but because they are far too short. I love visiting archives, gathering material, and interviewing people. And I love sitting in a room by myself with the phone turned down, lost in my own world, writing. You can't believe how satisfying it is when the manuscript is finished and a whole team of people, your editor, copy editor, indexer, cover designer, and publicist, busy themselves turning it into a beautiful object that bears your name. Then your book is out there in the world, bookshops, out there in the bookshops, you hope, being talked about in the press. You get letters from strangers thanking you for transporting them to another world. In one way, I haven't changed at all since I was 9. I still think there is nothing more exciting than being a writer. Thank you.